Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Ana Mateo, Jonathan Evans, Susan Shand, and Brian Lynn. But first, the Higher Education Report with Phil Dierking.
Young people graduating from colleges and universities in the United States face increasing amounts of debt. Some colleges, however, are now offering students another way to pay for their studies. They pay for a student's education in return for a percentage of the student's future salary. Norwich University in the state of Vermont announced Tuesday that it will become the latest school to offer this kind of contract. The contracts are called income share agreements. Norwich's program is starting out small. It is mostly for students who cannot get other loans or those who are taking longer than the traditional 8 semesters to finish their degree. Lauren Wabi is the school's chief financial officer and treasurer. Wabi said, "Norwich University is committed to offering this new way to help pay for college in a way that aligns incentives and helps reduce financial barriers to degree completion. With traditional loans, students pay back the amount they borrowed with interest until the loan is paid off. Students with income share agreements, however, pay the school a percentage of their salary for a period of time. Those who support income share agreements say they give colleges a reason to help students find jobs that pay well after graduation. If students earn a lot of money, they can pay the college back sooner. Income share agreements also seem less risky for students who get a lower paying job or struggle to find work after graduation. If students are unemployed or earning below a set amount of money, they do not have to pay anything back." Claire McCann is Deputy Director for Education Policy at the research group New America. She said taking on the debt through a contract where you don't take on a debt per se, but instead will repay a portion of your future income, has a certain appeal to students when the concept is fully explained to them. McCann, however, said that providers of income share agreements need to be careful. They could face unexpected problems in how they choose students for the program. For example, schools could be accused of discriminating against students who choose lower-paying professions. This is one of the biggest differences between income share agreements and federal student loans, McCann said. Federal loans offer the same terms to all borrowers. Income share agreements are not a new idea. They were first proposed by Milton Friedman in 1955. Yale University experimented with the idea in the 1970s for a short time. In the past 10 years, technical training programs such as computer coding programs have used income share agreements because trainees cannot get federal student loans. In 2015, Vimo Education in Oakton, Virginia, began working with colleges and universities to design financial programs based on income. The company works with nearly 30 public and private colleges and universities, including Norwich University. Vimo's first partnership was with Purdue University. It began providing money for the school's Back a Boiler Income Share Agreement program in 2016. Andrew Hoyler, 22, graduated from Purdue last year with a degree in professional flight with the goal of becoming a pilot. Now, he is working as a pilot for American Airlines regional company, PSA Airlines. One of the biggest pros for the income share agreement was the fact that out-of-college pilots do not make a lot of money, especially looking at the costs for an educational program, Hoyler said. The terms of the agreement, such as the length of the agreement and the salary percentage, can be different for each contract. Hoyler is currently paying 8% of his income. Since it can be difficult to predict what a student's future salary will be, it is also difficult to predict how much a student will pay back over time. However, most agreements do place a limit on the amount paid back. Hoyler took out federal loans, but said the income share agreement helped him avoid working several jobs while starting out last year as a flight teacher. Hoyler said he might pay more for the income share agreement over a long period of time as his salary rises, but he considers the choice worth the cost. I'm Phil Dierking.
Now, the VOA Learning English program, Words and Their Stories. On this program, we explore common expressions in American English. Today, we are talking about two things that at first seem unrelated: changing your mind and shoes. Okay, first, shoes. In the summertime, many people around the world wear a kind of casual shoe known as flip-flops. They are completely open, so they keep feet cool in warm weather. They are also good to wear in the shower, at the beach, or by a swimming pool, anywhere wet. Word and shoe experts both agree that flip-flops come from Japan. An article in the New York Times explains that after the Second World War ended, Japan increased its production of rubber. Among other things, workers used rubber to make a version of a traditional Japanese sandal called the zori. Japan exported these rubber zoris all over the world. But the public did not keep the name zori. The rubber sandals became known as flip-flops. Can you hear why? Flip-flop is the sound the shoes make when you walk in them. So that's some information about the flip-flop we wear on our feet. But another way we use the word flip-flop in American English has nothing to do with shoes. When you flip-flop, you completely change your mind on an issue. Not only do you adjust your thinking, but you adopt the exact opposite position. For example, maybe one day you announce to your roommates that you have become a vegetarian. You plan to eat only vegetables, beans, rice, and pasta. But at the end of the week, you make another announcement. You say you've changed your mind, and now you will only eat meat. You have flip-flopped. Word historians say this usage of flip-flop began around 1930 and comes from the world of electronics. Flip-flop referred to switching circuits that alternate between two states. Today, we most commonly use the term flip-flop in politics. Being accused of flip-flopping is usually not good. Let's say you are running for a political office. Early in your political career, perhaps you supported a popular issue, such as tax breaks for businesses. But now supporting that issue is not popular. So during the campaign, you tell voters that you've changed your mind. You are now against tax breaks for businesses. Your opponent could accuse you of being weak, of not knowing what you believe in, or of changing your position to get more votes. A candidate who flip-flops for political gain usually gives a bad impression. Voters come to know you as a flip-flopper. Another more neutral expression that means about the same as flip-flop is to do a 180. By the way, you can spell 180 with either numbers or letters. The pronunciation is the same. If you turn 180 degrees around a circle, you will be facing in the opposite direction. So you can use this term simply to mean turn around. For example, you could say that when your friend saw her ex-boyfriend coming toward her at a party, she did a 180 and quickly walked away. That is the literal meaning. Figuratively, doing a 180 means you completely change your opinion, or you make a big change in your lifestyle. In our earlier example about flip-flopping from being a vegetarian to eating meat, you could also say you did a 180. That expression sounds less critical than flip-flop. At work, you may not want to say that your boss flip-flopped on an important issue. Saying she did a 180 is more polite. You could also say that she reversed her earlier opinion. Better still, you can say her opinion evolved. Using the word evolved gives the impression that she changed her opinion over a long period of time and after thinking about it very carefully. In other words, if you do not want to offend someone, you might want to save your flip-flops for the beach. And that's the end of this Words and Their Stories. I'm Ana Mateo.
Twenty-five young musicians from around the world have come to California to train and perform this month. They will take part in an international program called Ipalpiti. The name comes from the Italian word for heartbeats. Eduard Schmieder is the program's conductor and musical director. Schmieder and his wife started the program in 1997 with help from violinist and conductor Yehudi Menuhin. This year, the musicians come from 19 countries, including Azerbaijan, Kazakhstan, Israel, and Italy. Schmieder notes some of the musicians are from countries that are at war with each other.
And they're sitting next to each other and they become friends.
He says, through their music and friendship, they are making the world more peaceful. The musicians taking part in the program range in age from their late teens to their 30s. Schmieder said they include winners of major music competitions. Peter Reiner is a violin player from Germany. He serves as concertmaster, the link between the musicians and conductor.
It's so great that you have so many sensitive musicians and they all are very alert and awake and listen to each other, and it's a lot of fun.
Turkish viola player Can Sakul says the international group works well together. The experience is a cultural as well as a musical exchange, said Russian violinist Semyon Promo.
Everyone has own opinion about music, how to play every composition, and very interesting to interact with everybody, to play together and to create one opinion for everybody.
This year, the festival focuses on music from the 1600s to the 1900s. But cello player Francisco Vila of Ecuador said the music has no geographic boundaries. Vila added that the musicians get to know more about each other as they perform great music.
It's interesting to see where we intersect, how many things we have in common. And also the music world is quite small, so you're only one person away from knowing everyone else.
Chan Sakul said the musicians who have taken part in the training and festival make up a big family. He added that he is proud to be a part of it. I'm Jonathan Evans.
A small group of Iranian farmers drove their tractors to the entrance to the town of Varzaneh. The vehicles stopped next to a canal that once provided their crops, but has been dry for years. The farmers appealed to government officials for help. "We are the people," shouted Mostafa Benvidi. "Help the people. At night, they go to bed hungry." The demonstrators held signs with the names of officials they blame for their dried-up fields. "How long will you eat your bread made with our blood?" one sign read. Every day, farmers hold a small protest outside the Iranian town of Varzaneh. The demonstration is a sign of the anger that has been growing over water shortages caused by years of little rainfall. But experts say the drought conditions have worsened because of mistakes by the government. Protests have grown larger with incidents of violence at a time when economic problems have fueled unrest repeatedly over the past year. In March, police clashed with farmers who held a sit-in strike in Varzaneh. Mostafa Benvidi was wounded and lost sight in his left eye during the clashes. Today, he has more than 100 pellet shots in his body. Earlier this month, in another part of southern Iran, 11 people were wounded when police broke up a protest in Khorramshahr. Those protesters said their drinking water is dirty. Officials just come and promise to deal with the crisis and then just leave, said the 30-year-old Benvidi. He and his family used to grow corn, cotton, and other crops on their 3-hectare farm, but they have not been able to farm for years because of lack of water. Now, Benvidi is unemployed. His family earns money from the seasonal building work his brothers get in nearby towns. His sister makes carpets to sell. Over the past 10 years, Iran has experienced its worst drought in more than 30 years, according to the United Nations Food and Agricultural Organization. Iran's Meteorological Organization estimates that 97% of the country is affected. The dry conditions have affected Isfahan province, where Varzaneh is located, and other parts of central Iran. The Zayandeh Rud River once provided water to the area. The water came down from the Zagros Mountains through the city of Isfahan and through farming towns, including Varzaneh. But the river dried up years ago. The fields around Varzaneh are now dry dirt. Around 90% of the farming activities have ended, said Reza Kahlili, an environmental activist. Government policies have worsened the effects of the drought and growing population, Kahlili and other observers say. The government is building more factories, taking large amounts of water. In July, officials opened a steel factory in Isfahan. Water has also been sent to other areas. The normal water system has been destroyed, and all the water has been set aside for businesses, explained Kahlili. Outside of Varzaneh, migrating birds once stopped at a wetlands. Now the area is an empty field of salt that causes sandstorms. The people of Varzaneh are proud of the town's history. It sent hundreds of its young men to fight in the Iran-Iraq War in the 1980s. More than 100 were killed in the fighting, and their memory is still important. Now young men leave the area in search of a better life. Many of my friends moved to near and far towns to find jobs, said Ruhola Sohrabi, a farmer who now works as a builder in other cities. In 2012, farmers in Varzaneh fought with police and broke a pipe that transports water from Isfahan to the neighboring province of Yazd. Similar protests continued from 2016 to now. At one time, the government paid around $250 to each family affected by the crisis. But people want a real solution. More social conflict may be on the way. Officials do not have the necessary expertise to manage water resources, said Hamid Safavi, a professor at Isfahan University of Technology. Safavi said each province decides on its own how to use its water without looking at the effect it has on the larger area. Unless policies change, we are heading from a water crisis to a disaster, he added. I'm Susan Shand.
The combined California ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach are the largest in the United States. An estimated $417 billion worth of goods pass through the two ports each year. About $362 billion of that comes from trade with the Asia-Pacific area. But businesses using the ports are expecting a sharp rise in shipping costs because of tariffs announced by the United States and China. Liang Yang owns an import company in Los Angeles that deals mainly with toys and clothes from China. He told VOA he has had concerns about his business in recent weeks after hearing about planned tariff increases.
I've been watching the news every day. When will the tariffs be put in place? When are my goods arriving? It's a fight against time. I'm trying to order all my products for the rest of the year.
Liang said he expects a 10 to 20% increase in shipping costs if a trade war breaks out between the U.S. and China. He said if tariffs were to increase more than 20%, he would be forced to raise the prices of his goods. Stephen Chung is president of the Los Angeles-based World Trade Center. The center provides assistance to international companies seeking to bring or expand operations in the area. He said that as tariffs from both countries increase the cost of goods, manufacturers and sellers may order fewer products. This, Chung said, would result in a decrease in overall trade between the U.S. and China.
Once that happens, you're going to see an increase in the rates for shipping, because when you don't have the volume to justify the goods going back and forth, you're going to see a further increase in that shipping cost.
Chung said this rise in shipping costs would eventually result in higher prices for people buying the products. Other officials at the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach say it is still too early to tell what effect additional trade tariffs will have. Duane Kanagi is currently deputy director of the Port of Long Beach. He told VOA that so far, the port has seen record container business this year. For now, Kanagi is waiting to see how different businesses change their supply operations to deal with the tariff environment. But he warned that a continuing trade war could be devastating to both the U.S. and Chinese economies. President Donald Trump and other U.S. officials have accused China of carrying out unfair trading practices. The officials say tariffs are needed to reduce a large trade imbalance. The United States imported more than $500 billion in Chinese goods last year, compared to $130 billion in U.S. products exported to China. Importer Liang Liang remains hopeful that a U.S.-China trade war can be avoided. He said he thought recent announcements on tariffs were made for political purposes and may not last. Stephen Chung said he understands the reasons the United States decided to announce heavy tariffs on Chinese imports. But he urged administration officials to carefully consider how such changes will affect local importers. What are the steps you're going to use to mitigate some of these damages that will be happening to the local community? These are huge issues that have not been addressed yet, he said. I'm Brian Lynn.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.